CMU podcast in association with 7 Digital.
This week, the Digital Pi, Amazon Prime Music, Contactor, and Zayn Malik. I'm Andy Malt. I'm the editor of CMU. I have with me Chris Cook. He's the business editor of CMU. And before we start this week, I just want to mix things up a bit and say right up front, if you enjoy this quality... Don't interrupt me. If you enjoy this quality online broadcasting, why not subscribe to it, rate it, and share it with... review it as well, and share it with all your friends. I just wanted to say that up front, because I worry that people have turned off by the time they get to the end, and that's why they're all forgetting to do it.
Does that mean that you, having done... How many podcasts have we done in this series now?
About 70 or 80.
You finally sort of figured, yeah, no one's staying tuned for the whole 49 minutes.
Which they're missing out, because there's some quality stuff in that.
It is. I mean, I would say on pretty much every podcast we've recorded, particularly this series, the really good stuff is in the last 4 or 5 minutes. I'm pretty confident.
Not even that, last 30 seconds.
If we were to go back when you're reading the generic ending script.
Yeah.
Well, we've just done it. You've just done the final 30 seconds.
I've done a bit of it. I might do it again later.
So that means you've blown it. The only thing worth sticking around for, and you've put it out there right at the start. So, yeah. Perhaps we could.
Oh, well, it's too late to start again now.
Do something really good during the approved section to justify staying tuned.
Yeah.
I'm not quite sure what that's going
to
be.
Well, everyone stay tuned to see if we do something worth staying tuned for. That's my tip for this week.
I'm looking forward to it.
Good. So let's get straight on with it then. This is the stuff worth sticking around for. Let's talk about the Digital Pi. What's the Digital Pi?
Yes, it's quite surprising that we've not talked about the Digital Pi on the CMU podcast before, given that we have now been back a couple of months. And this is a story that has been coming back again and again and again this year, but I suppose particularly at the start of the year when the podcast wasn't happening. So that's why we've not talked about this one through this medium, although we have talked about it a lot in the CMU Daily.
And at the Great Escape.
We had a big debate about it at CMU at the Great Escape, and therefore it was in the CMU Trends Report that followed the Great Escape.
What you're saying is we've covered this. Don't think we haven't covered it, but we're going to cover it some more.
We're going to cover it some more for those people. I'm not saying the people who can't read, but won't read. Okay, so those people who are interested in music, but not so interested in music that they would read words, we're gonna talk about it here. And then I think...
Well, this sounds perfect for me.
We've touched every base. So the Digital Pi debate is basically what happens to the money that comes in from digital services and, I suppose, particularly streaming services. So we know that artists are not hugely impressed. Well, Ed Sheeran's probably impressed with the money he's seeing coming in from Spotify, etc., and a handful of other overly streamed artists too. But a lot of artists, certainly newer artists and some sort of more niche established artists, are not impressed with the royalties they're seeing coming in on their statements from the streaming services in particular. Songwriters have become particularly vocal on this issue this year. Artists have been moaning about this for some time. Obviously, Tom York, that seems like a lifetime ago now, doesn't it? When Tom York. took to Twitter to diss specifically Spotify. But then this year's songwriters, mind you, Tom York is also a songwriter, isn't it? But I know for a fact that Tom York was dissing Spotify in his guise as an artist, because songwriters didn't start officially dissing Spotify, etc., until this year.
Okay. Yeah, because as usual, songwriters only noticed 5 years after everybody else. And also, not that I'm dissing songwriters, but you're all idiots.
Music publishers, so those people, the corporate partners of songwriters, have also initially, off the record, unofficially, been dissing the royalties that are coming in. And actually what we're going to talk about now is they're coming increasingly on the record on this. So lots of people are not impressed with the money they're seeing coming in from digital services and specifically streaming services. However, the group that are absent from that list I've just read out are record companies. And I suppose the gist of this debate is that whenever artists or songwriters or publishers stand up at conferences or they do interviews And they lay into Spotify-type services. Let's put Apple Music in there too.
Yeah.
Apple Music's complicated because of the whole side debate. But when they lay into streaming platforms and say, we're just not making enough money, these bloody digital startups, you know, they're worth billions and they're not paying us enough money. And that's how most of these conversations have begun. Certainly that was how Tom York, he was very much laying into the service itself and the people who back that service and the founders of the service. But increasingly people have been saying, well, is the problem the money that the services are taking, or is the problem that the record companies, that the other stakeholder in all of this, they are taking the vast majority of the money? Now, when it comes to how the money is divvied up, so every pound that comes in for a subscription, say, to Spotify, quite how it's divvied up between the different stakeholders, we don't know precisely, because all the deals that set this in stone are secret, apart from the one Sony Music deal that conveniently got leaked.
But we've got, partly because of that, but partly anyway, we've got a rough idea of where the money goes.
We do. So for each pound that comes in, let's ignore sales tax. So let's assume that this is after, you know, George Osborne has taken his 20%.
Oh,
so
George.
For the pound that comes in, the DSP is looking to keep about 30% of that. Now, as we understand it, both Tidal and Apple Music are willing to accept a slightly lower cut. They're going more 25, 27%. But in the main, most digital services are looking for about a 30% cut. And they would say two things. A, well, that's sort of what the record shop took on a CD.
Yep.
So the idea there being a middleman who takes, you know, nearly a third of the money, that's not a new thing, okay? And the streaming services sort of see themselves as the new retailers. The other thing they would say, and they explicitly said this in a report from the Entertainment Retailers Association earlier this year, is if we don't take 30% of the money, we cannot exist. You know, we're all the streaming services.
It's
already
going back to what we were discussing last week about Apple taking a 30% cut of subscriptions, which was all of the services money.
Yeah, the DSP's cut. And so, as I say, they see themselves as retailers in the UK. The streaming services are all members of the Entertainment Retail Association, along with traditional record shops and download stores. And they put out a report earlier this year. And although it wasn't credited to any one specific streaming service, basically there was a whole section of that report saying to everyone else in the music industry, 30% is as low as we go. And those of you who are saying we should go down to 20%, it just won't work. Okay, there is not a business for us, bearing in mind these services, none of these services are making any money yet, but there isn't a long-term business for us unless we have 30%. So let's assume the DSP is going to take 30%. As I say, Tidal and Apple Music have sort of reopened that debate since that era report by going a little bit less. But they're looking for about 30%. So what about the 70% that goes into the music industry? And we know that somewhere between 55 and 60% of the money overall is going to the record company. And about 10 to 15% is going to the music publishers. Because, of course, when I keep saying Spotify, I feel bad that that's the only streaming service I'm name-checking here. Because this applies to all streaming services. So I'm going to mix it up. Okay. So when Ardio streams a track, obviously they're exploiting two sets of copyright. They're exploiting the copyright in the sound recording, controlled by record companies and recording artists, and the copyright in the song, controlled by the publishers and the songwriters. So they need licenses for both. The point is that the money they pay for the permission to stream is different. So 55 to 60% of the money goes to the record company, 10 to 15% goes to the publishing side, sometimes direct, sometimes through the collecting societies. On the publishing side, of the 10 to 15p of each pound that comes in, that probably gets split pretty much 50-50 between the songwriter and the publisher. If the songwriter hasn't recouped on their publishing deal, they might not see all of the money straight away. But ultimately, it's generally in publishing split 50-50. If anything, actually, the songwriter might get more of the money. That's just the way it works in publishing. On the record industry side, the 55 to 60p that is going to the record company, they have to share some of that with the artist. But that is all subject to contract, okay? Yeah. So it'll depend on what the artist contract says. Most artist contracts will pay a minority royalty to the artist. Some indies do 50-50 deals, but most record companies and certainly the majors will, on a CD, would have been paying probably somewhere around 15% of the money to artists. And in the main, they're paying a similar split on streams, maybe a few percent more, but certainly no more than 20%. So the record company overall, if we were to draw a pie chart, the digital pie chart, what we would see is, even if we make a sort of a reasonable estimate for what the artists are getting, bearing in mind, again, this is subject to the artist being recouped on their contract, if the artist hasn't paid back the label, their advance, and any other costs that the artist is due to cover, then they're seeing nothing. But if they've recouped on contract, the label is still keeping the lion's share of the money. And so these other stakeholders, artists, publishers, songwriters, they're all saying, we're not making enough money out of digital. If we accept what the streaming services are saying, which is we go no lower than 30%, where else can we get money from? Hang on a second. The record company is taking more of this money than anybody else involved in this. Surely we should get some of the record company's cut. So the label should take less so that artists and songwriters and publishers can take more. And this is a debate that has been rumbling on for a few years now, but particularly this year in terms of looking at what the cut the record company is taking and saying, is this a fair way to do it?
Yeah, and I mean, arguably, it's a debate they should have been having several years ago when these licences were being carved up, rather than just going, oh yeah, we'll just do it how, like with CDs, yeah, fine, whatever. This streaming thing's not going to take off anyway. But, you know, better late than never.
So better late than never.
The debate's happening now, and it's I suppose the kind of the elephant in the room is the label cut. And it's not a lot of people have gone on record to say we want all your money or half the money, but some Germans have.
It's true.
Good old Germans. So an alliance of trade groups representing publishers, composers, and lyricists in Germany.
Yes, this is the big digital pie development this week.
Yes, this is this week. They've come forward and they said, yeah, we should definitely there should definitely be a split of 50-50 between labels and publishers in. On digital revenues, because the risk that the labels are taking is far, far less. They're not paying to manufacture anything. There's no cost of making CDs, distributing CDs. You're just putting some MP3s into a computer, and then they go down the pipes, however the internet works, and then they pop up in another computer, and then everyone can listen to them. That's basically how, that's it. That's how streaming works.
It is, because obviously one of the reasons why the CD model, so the percentages we've talked about today with digital are quite similar to the percentages on a CD. Actually, the publishers get a bit more of streaming than they did on a CD, but they're quite similar. And as you say, that was sort of set up various reasons, but well, the big reason being it's expensive pressing CDs. It's expensive getting CDs around the country. It's a big risk involved in that.
Well, there's the marketing cost as well, which is, you know, that's the label's burden, usually.
And so the argument is, OK, in CD, we reluctantly accepted the way it was because the label took a big risk. They spent a lot of money. But surely your risk and your costs are less in the digital age than they were in the CD age. And there is precedent here because obviously there are other ways that music companies make money out of recorded music other than selling CDs or downloads or streams. There's money to be made when music gets played on the radio. There's money to be made when music gets played in a public space. And broadcast and public performance income that has come into the industry, that has always been split 50-50 because the assumption is, well, nobody here is taking the bigger risk. Nobody here is pumping in lots of money when the music's played on the radio or it's played in a public arena. Then the money comes in and we split it 50-50. The publishers and the songwriter get half the money and the artists and labels get half the money. And actually, within each bit of the industry, it's then split 50-50. So the publisher and the songwriter take a 50-50 split. And with radio and public performance, artist and the label take a 50-50 split. So everybody gets 25%. So there is precedent there. Although, as you said, up until now, when the digital pie debate has been happening informally or at the Great Escape, formally on stage, although the songwriters and the publishers were saying we should be getting more, the status quo is well, it's not fair. And actually, the songwriters in particular have been saying it's not sustainable. The songwriters will all go out of business. Not quite sure what that means, but they'll all stop writing songs if we don't get this sorted. But no one has actually gone as far as saying we should take the radio model, the 50-50 split, and we should apply it to streaming because whereas iTunes was the record shop online, what's Spotify, Deezer, RDO, Napster, Tidal, rah-rah.com? It's just a digital manifestation of a radio type service.
Yeah.
So let's now, do the 50-50 split.
I mean, arguably, I'll defend the labels.
You defend the briefly. Record companies.
I mean, I think the labels would argue that it's not a 50-50 split in terms of work on digital services, it's the labels who are, I mean, there is a lower cost of distribution, but there is still a cost of distribution of online music.
And you mentioned the marketing thing.
There is a cost of marketing.
And the marketing thing has not changed. It's as expensive to market it. If anything, it's more expensive.
But in, you know, and in terms of radio, obviously, like the 50% split on radio, I suppose labels would accept that because they would see, although they are, it's them who's doing the radio plugging, so there is a marketing cost to them to get that music on radio that then is split 50-50. But they would see that, you know, the music being played on the radio then sells CDs.
And
in,
also,
you know, in the past,
lots of radio stations are playing catalogue music where no one is actually doing any marketing. It is just work we all did 10, 20 years ago that we're still earning from, so it's fair enough to split it 50-50.
But if you're saying, well, it's just 50-50 for everything, let's just forget, let's assume that, like, all physical product, is, I don't know, is all destroyed in a fire or something, and we decided not to have any more. If it's all digital and radio and TV, that's all we've got, and everything's split 50-50, then the labels are down, unless, you know, there's some dramatic reconfiguration of how the music industry works, which there should be. But at the, you know, in the current situation, you split everything 50-50. The labels are spending a lot of money promoting and, you know, having the stuff recorded. There's not, I don't know, publishers don't. It's not, I'm not saying publishers don't have costs, but they do not have the same costs as the labels.
There's also, I mean, some sort of copyright technicalities in that if you're a record company and you put out a recording, you own the copyright in that recording of the song, but you don't own the copyright in any subsequent recordings of the song. Whereas if you're the publisher, you own the copyright in the song, and then every single time that song is performed or covered or replayed, you're earning again and again and again and again. And also, you know, the publishers earn when music gets played live, whereas the record companies don't, because when it's played live, there is no recording being used, so they don't see anything. So there's an argument that the song copyrights have more revenue streams to come in. So on this one revenue stream, the original recordings that the labels pay to make, to distribute and to market, the labels should be getting a much bigger chunk of the money.
And it's that lack of more revenue streams that have meant that, you know, labels are increasingly asking artists to sign away cuts of other revenue streams, like their merch, things like that.
Although is an argument on the publisher's side here.
Because I suppose.
The publishers could say, hang on a second. Whenever you sign, you're saying, oh, we're investing in new talent and that's very expensive and it's risky, and that's right. But if all of your new talent deals now also include a cut of merch or brand or whatever it is that you're taking, you, the label, are no longer just in the copyright business. Whereas we, the publishers and the songwriters, all we have is the copyright. If you're a songwriter who is not also an artist, you can't sell any merchandise, you can't do any sponsorship deals, you're just reliant on the copyright. So if the labels, as the principal investors in new artists, are off making money elsewhere, then we down the chain, where we just work on copyright, should be getting a bigger chunk of that money. So, yeah, hey, you wheeled it back into the publisher's side there.
Damn it.
So as you
Sorry, labels.
The big development
50-50
on this,
it is then.
We've settled it.
Yeah.
Is the German publishers. Now, the German publishers had a little press conference at MIDEM earlier this year to sort of formally express their concern about the royalties they were paying. Although at that event, they weren't explicit at saying this is the label's fault. They seem to be laying more into the streaming services themselves. Although, from what I could see, a lot of what they were moaning about was problems with their collective licensing system rather than anything that the labels or the digital services have done. Whereas this week they've come much more explicit at saying, I'm not sure they've forgiven the streaming services. I think they still have some fundamental problems with what the streaming services are doing themselves. And hey, if Spotify ever does float, and I think people still think it will next year, and the founders and the early investors make millions and millions and millions on the back of that, then they're going to get really angry. But the thing they've put on the agenda this week is the digital pie debate that we had at The Great Escape, which is we need to reposition it. And whereas lots of people, not record company people, but lots of people are saying actually the current makeup isn't right and the labels should be taking slightly less and the artists and the songwriters and the publishers should be getting slightly more for all the reasons we talked about. But what the Germans have put on the table this week is we do want 50-50, and it will be interesting to see how this debate now runs forward. You sort of sense that the labels, when forced to, would list all of the things that you listed in your gallant defence of the record company.
That's why I listed
it. But actually, the labels have tried not to get into this debate in any formal way. And you sense that what the record companies are hoping is they're thinking the reason why the songwriters and the publishers are getting so sort of, you know, tetchy about this at the moment is because the streaming market is still in early days. And the reason they're seeing not very much money is because, well, streaming services actually aren't making that much money yet. They're growing rapidly, but actually overall, they're not as big as anything like they should be in 5 years' time. So the labels are thinking, if the digital pie can just grow so that the streaming services bring in more money and ultimately more money than the record industry ever brought in, then the publishers and the songwriters will suddenly start to see their royalty checks go up again.
And they'll think it's been done anyway.
Well, the fact that they're only getting 10, 15% of the money, whereas the DSP is getting 30 and the label's getting 45, 50 once they've paid the artist share, they won't care about the percentage splits once the checks start going up. So you sense that the labels were hoping that they could sort of just not take part in this debate and hope that eventually it would sort itself out. Although the fact that those German associations have gone so vocal on it this week suggests that this is an argument that is going to have to be had. Quite how and where, I don't know. What it does mean is that those DSPs, again, because they are licensees of both, are sort of going to be caught in the middle. So, developments on the digital pie debate, it ain't going anywhere yet.
You were trying to think of names of other streaming services. I've got one for you. Amazon Prime Music.
It didn't come to mind, did it?
No, but it's there.
Long drawn out digital pie.
It is right there, launched in the UK this very week.
It should have been in my head for that very reason.
Exactly, yeah, it was in my head and I thought I'm going to save that for a really good segue. Which I've now done. I hope everyone noticed. These are the things you should be hanging around for.
Exactly.
These are the things.
There's another bit of exciting bonus content still.
Amazon Prime Music is a different sort of music streaming service. I mean, for one thing, it's a perk as an addition to something else. Amazon Prime is a next day delivery service that you can pay membership for, £79 a year, I think. And it just means anything you order on Amazon turns up next day. It's very clever.
It's a
club. Not via drone yet, but one day. Apparently that story's come back. Anyway, let's not get into that. So as a perk of Amazon Prime, there's already a video streaming service or a movie streaming service. Love Film Instant. Love Film, the DVD delivery service, still exists as Love Film. Love Film Instant, as it was called, became Amazon Prime Movies, which if you were a Love Film subscriber like I am, you get that as just a thing on its own. But if you're an Amazon Prime subscriber, you get it as a bonus, as a thank you for spending £79 a year on delivery.
And presumably they've signed up the Top Gear free, haven't they, Amazon?
Yeah, yeah.
So presumably that'll be part of Prime membership.
Like Netflix, they do exclusive content, but obviously in Amazon's case, doing exclusive content on their video service is to try to get people to sign up for their delivery service. And now they've added this music service as well. So it's just kind of throwing stuff in.
I think, and there's other stuff, isn't there? Because I think there's some ebook stuff going on in there.
There's various bits and pieces.
So yeah, so it's a club that offers all of these different services. And so people, I mean, obviously, as you say, originally people joined because of the super duper distribution thing. It may well be, since they started adding all these extra perks, that some people are coming in for the video or whatever. But the music bit went live in the US about a year ago.
Yeah.
So they added streaming music to this sort of catalogue of services in America in 2014, but only in the US.
Yeah.
And when it launched, it was interesting on a number of levels, not least from our sort of perspective of, well, what royalties are they paying to the record companies?
Well, yes, how do you work out how much of that £79, dollars, well, I'm not sure, I think it's $99 in the States. I'm trying to remember how much it was when I accidentally bought it.
Well, yes,
when
they launched the American version.
I was trying to use the music service when it launched. Yeah, how much of that money that someone's paid for membership of the Amazon Club is, you know, part of this video service, this music service rather. It's a different music service in that it's kind of a bolt-on to a thing, but it's also different in that it's not a fully fledged Spotify-style, everything in the world possible, listen to it now service. It has a catalogue of a million tracks.
So there's still a lot of tracks.
But I think it's mainly focused at a different audience. It's really focused around playlists. There are kind of, I think they've got, the UK version at launch has about 500 curated playlists. And it's sort of trying to mimic, I guess, well, like we were talking about last week, the kind of hits radio, just playing you the same songs that you already know over and over again. We'll slip a few in here and there, but, you know, not enough so as to piss you off.
And I suppose none of the obsession with new music all the time and discovery.
No, it really kind of focused on the older stuff.
Because a lot of those million tracks are not the latest releases.
And, in fact, it doesn't have brand new releases, no, as I remember.
Well, there are two reasons for it being this way. Reason one is simply the licensing reason. So as you said, we explained at length earlier in this podcast how the Spotify pound is divvied up. But the Amazon Prime pound can't be divvied up 55% to the record company because, well, we've got to pay for the distribution, we've got to pay for the video service, we've got to pay for the ebook service and everything else. So how much is left for the record companies? It's not going to be a lot of money. Even less for the publishers. And so, therefore, when Amazon over in the US originally went to the labels and the publishers to negotiate this, they had to compromise and say, well, clearly we're not going to get a Spotify-type service. So we'll go for the million tracks, we'll go for the older catalogue, blah, blah, blah. And they managed to do the deal on smaller royalties. So part of it is just that that's all they can get away with on that price point. But I think Amazon would also argue, you kept saying this is for a different sort of customer, and Amazon would say, well, exactly that. Not only, this isn't just like this because that's all we could license on the budget, it's like this because this is what we think our customers want. Our customers are not Spotify customers, they're not Apple Music customers, they are much more casual music fans. They will never sign up for a specific music service.
But they're people who think getting a CD the next day is still clever.
that's still sort of high tech. And so what they're sort of saying is, but if we throw a bit of music in, these people will use that service and then we'll pay some royalties back to the industry. So we have a music platform, a streaming music platform that appeals to a totally different demographic. So even though you, the music industry, aren't making anywhere near as much as you are from your Spotify and your Deezer deals, it's new income from new customers and you should be happy with it. And that we are doing, we is Amazon, not CMU. I'm being Amazon there.
Okay.
We are doing that thing which the music industry talks about a lot. Certainly we talk about a lot and we talked about it last week.
Wait, are you talking about, are we CMU or Amazon now?
We're everybody.
Okay.
Everybody's saying this. Me. Okay, I'm saying this. I've been saying it a lot. I said it last week on the CMU podcast, which is that if you look at the wider consumer base, a relatively small slice of the population will be interested in £120 a year, 30 million tracks, discovery, all of that. It's a relatively small consumer base. There's many, many, many more customers who like music, but they won't sign up for a specific service. They certainly won't pay $120 a year for it. But there's a lot of them. And we need to find a way of getting a little bit of money out of all of them.
And those people are probably more likely to use a service that comes just as a free add-on to something they already pay for. And just plays them stuff they already know they like.
So there is an argument that when we keep saying we need to find a middle market streaming service, actually it already exists in Amazon Prime. The point was, though, until this week, it only existed in the US. But this is presumably a sign that they're going to now start rolling it out around the world. This was just a UK launch this week. But Amazon's quite unique streaming service aimed at a very different audience to all of the others, who are all basically competing for the same crowd, is now here in the UK. So if you're a casual music fan, not quite sure why you're listening to the CMU podcast if you're a casual music fan, but if you are, that's there to choose from. And it will be interesting to see, you know, what is the uptake and what will that revenue stream look like? Because although you're getting a lot less money per user, ultimately Amazon Prime will have many, many more users than any full-on streaming service. So actually the revenue stream long-term could be a decent revenue stream. Perhaps that will be the revenue stream that fixes everything and shuts up those moaning publishers.
I mean, it's not only the race for users that all the other streaming services have and the kind of panic to get, you know, enough million users to make your service viable. It's of less concern to Amazon because really, as long as they're getting people signing up to Amazon Prime, the delivery service, that's all they care about. You know, as I say, this is a bolt-on thing. So it's an interesting angle. As you say, we'll see how it goes.
And what does it mean financially for the music industry? These things are always shrouded in secrecy. But long-term, Amazon Prime could be an important little line on the average label and artist's royalty statement. OK, it's time for the CMU approved part of the podcast, which I think is perhaps where I promised there would be the extra little nugget of gold that justifies
you're damn right
listening all the way through. Actually, we're going to put the nugget of gold into the and finally bit, because
right, okay.
Otherwise we'll lose
just
everyone.
Just look at what we're talking about. Oh, yeah, OK.
Yes. So we'll save the extra bonus little bit of quality content for the final section of the podcast.
So keep Keep hanging on.
Keep hanging on. But let's not forget that the Andy's shouting at you to share this podcast and rate it.
Do share it.
We've already done that, and that's not going to be happening.
And rate it. And review it.
So it's CMU approved.
And subscribe.
Why don't you justify what you approved this week? For God's sake, let's start with Kiara.
Kiara? Sorry, I'm not sure why I started.
You almost launched into the old Kiora orange squash advert there.
It's too orangey for crows. Yeah. I'm not going to do the voice on that. I think that was another time. Kiara is someone who I heard on the All Back No Front podcast, which is John Hillcock's podcast, which, I mean, that might be the gold that you've been waiting for, is my suggestion that you go and listen to that podcast.
Another podcast. Yeah, I bet you all rate that one.
It's a very good podcast. And has music like Kiara on it, who this is the second track she's released. She's working with Felix Snow, who produces Scissor, who is another CMU-approved artist from yesteryear. And it's got quite a, I guess, because she's done two tracks and it's the same producer. It's got a very distinct sound. It's kind of cut-up R&B pop. She's got quite a familiar but slightly distinct voice, which I'm enjoying. And I think if... You never know. People can go off the rails a bit once they've done two good tracks, but I'm hoping that she sort of continues on this same rails that she's on and does an album that is as good throughout.
Let's move off this, because I've now got the Kiora advert in my head, so I need help to get rid of that. Jeanne is next.
Jeanne. She is a pop star from Lithuania, which is not a sentence you hear very often.
But, unless you live in Lithuania, presumably.
Or if you read the CMU Approved column, because this is the second time she has featured in it. It's very slick pop. It's, you know, unless you were told that she was from Lithuania, I don't think you'd listen to it and think Lithuanian. I'm not sure what would make me think that. But anyway, it's a bit like, it's kind of Sia-esque. It's very good. I mean, she's got a lot of good songs.
So go check.
She's another one. A lot of good singles. No album as yet. Hoping that she's got like half an album. Hoping that the other half will be good.
Yes. It's not that she's put out all the killer and now all that is to come is filler.
Let's hope not.
Jim Perkins.
Jim Perkins. He's also someone who features semi-regularly in CMU. He's a composer and producer, composer of classical music, but he treats it in a very modern way because his production influences are more kind of experimental electronic musicians. So this track that he's just released called Transfiguration, which is the first track off his new album, which is all strings. He did a solo piano album, and now he's doing a strings album with different amounts of string players on different tracks, from solo to 21 of them.
Does it go up over the album?
I don't know.
Or is it a guessing game? You have to guess how many
on each
track.
This is a quartet, but it's a quartet that he's basically sampled the quartet playing a piece and then kind of rebuilt it in the studio, kind of pulled it apart and constructed. So it's, I'm going to use that term, cut up again. But I like his work a great deal, and I'm very much looking forward to hearing this album.
In October.
Yes.
Memory Maze.
Memory Maze, our fourth and final approved artist this week, who releases a single this week, today, in fact, if you listen to the podcast as it comes out, called The Closest Thing to Heaven. He's a solo artist called Gavin Ellis. He's got a debut album coming out in October as well. And he's got a sound. It's sort of his songs are all sort of like a swirl of guitar and synth. And then he's got this quite breathy vocal. It's good. Good. I'm hoping that I might as well just make the name. I'm hoping that the rest of the album will be good. I think it will be. I think they'll all have brilliant albums.
Yeah, Matt could just take that out of this recording and then we could just reuse it every week on the CMU Approved slot.
You just read out the names and we'll just slot that in.
Yeah, yeah. If Andy ever has to take a week off, we're sorted. We can just reuse that line. In fact, actually, there were certain lines we use a lot on this podcast. I suspect we could do a cut-up CMU podcast.
We could.
The week we can't be here.
Well, it'll be interesting to see if we do that.
Blah, blah, blah. There you go. Some of our classic lines. Here's another classic line that I do every week, but that's because it's justified. CompleteMusicUpdate.com/approved to read more and listen to all of those tracks.
Yeah. Now, contacta, as I called it in the introduction to this podcast, because I looked up the pronunciation before we started and I listened to four different people say it and they all said contacta.
So I have
and
to
now
say,
you are telling me I'm wrong.
I'm not telling you wrong.
You're telling
what,
me I'm
what
wrong.
I'm actually saying is that for me, that's the nugget of gold of this podcast. I have learned. So V-contacta, which is not called V-contacta, even though it's written V-contacta, but it's Russian. And it's sort of the Russian Facebook.
Yeah, you can tell it's the Russian Facebook because it really looks like Facebook.
It's very similar to Facebook. So it's the biggest social network.
Once in a while, when we write about it, I have to go on V-contacta. And every time I go on there, I go, bloody hell, this looks like Facebook.
So it looks like Facebook of 4 years ago.
Yeah, not Facebook now. But
So it's a big social network in Russia. It's spelt V-contacta, but Andy Malt has done some research for this podcast. Who'd have thought it?
And see, apparently, this is what we do for you.
It's a silent V.
Yeah.
Who knew? I'm pretty sure.
Sometimes.
I'm not going to name and shame, but I'm pretty sure there was someone from the record industry who has been sort of leading on the litigation against this company, and I'm sure he was saying V-contacta. But hopefully, he listens to this podcast, and now he knows that you say contacta. Why have the record industry? Because, you know, the record industry aren't suing Facebook. They're not dissing Facebook. So why have they been so busy suing and dissing the Russian Facebook?
Well, this one has... It's a bit different.
The one thing they do that Facebook doesn't do.
It has a file sharing element to it. And that's a thing that record companies don't like. In fact, there's various bits of legal action against contacta over this, including from film companies. But Sony Music has been going in against...
All three of the major.
But this week they've reached a goodwill agreement with Sony Music. I don't know what that means.
Yes, now there's a possibility. I mean, I did slightly mock that expression in the See Me Daily. I sort of fear that it's just something lost in translation. But the record industry has been critical of contacta for a long time. There have been various points in recent years where contacta have said, oh, we want to be friends with the music industry. We're going to turn off that file sharing and we'll license a legal service. And they've said that several times. And hasn't happened.
They forget.
They were.
Oh, is it still on? Oh, sorry about that. Oh.
They were originally sued by Russian music companies and the Russian music companies won. And that was when they first said, oh, we're going to sort this out. And then nothing happened. Then the major labels worldwide started getting involved. The International Federation of the Phonographic Industry started putting out statements. They ended up on that list. There's a list that the American government do every year of the rogue websites list or something. And so the record industry kept lobbying to get voting it into the list of bad websites. And then there was various changes of management there. And then copyright law changed in Russia. And there have been various attempts to try and make contacta sort of become a legit music service rather than basically a file sharing platform. Last year, the major record companies finally went legal on this. They filed litigation, I think, in the St. Petersburg court. That's been rumbling on for a year now. There was due to be a hearing this week to consider that. So the labels have sued separately, but basically with pretty much the same lawsuit. And there was a scheduled court hearing to look at it this week. But before that court hearing could take place, as you say, a goodwill agreement was announced by contacta, which seemingly means that the Sony Music litigation has been cancelled, although we don't really know what this goodwill agreement consists of.
No. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because Russia and China are the two big areas of copyright difficulty, shall we say. I think both show. Well, we discussed, I think, last week that China as China becomes a more kind of global power, has sort of been making moves to try to become a bit more in line with how the rest of the world sees copyright. And Russia also was doing that for a while, although now Russia's fallen out with the rest of the world. And it's sort of, there was a thing this week where it looked like the Russian government was trying to buy a broadcaster there to stop them playing Western music. So there's. Russia's an interesting place for copyright
again. It is,
again.
And as you say, I mean, they have been doing a lot of revising of their copyright law in recent years, seemingly to put it into shape. Although most of the Western rights owners you speak to, it is very sort of... I remember someone saying that when you do a sync deal, okay, from a publishing side, there are two parts to a publishing sync deal, which you do, you get some money up front for the mechanical part of the copyright, the actual synchronization, and then every time your advert plays on TV or in the cinema, there is then a second royalty that comes in for the performing right bit, and that's normally collected through a collecting society, and that then works its way through the system and comes back to the rights owner. But this sync person was saying, but in Russia, you just never see the performing right money. So if you're doing the deal with a Western company for something that's going out in Russia, you just sort of informally say, yeah, we're never going to see that performing rights income, so we'll have the money up front, please, because we're sort of covering ourselves. So copyright is interesting in Russia, despite the fact that the government does keep making, you know, statements that, oh, we're sorting copyright law out, and in some ways they've been introducing some things that the labels would like to see introduced over here. But it is still quite hard to enforce your rights over there, and I put the V back in there for a moment. You taught me, and I've already forgotten. What was the point?
I don't know why I turn up.
So Contactor continued to allow this file-sharing thing to happen. What does this goodwill agreement mean? And I suppose the interesting thing is, does this mean there has been talk on a number of occasions about Contactor launching a streaming service on their platform, licensing it with the labels, whether or not the Russian government would then try and buy it to stop all Western music, we don't know. Just radio stations are trying to do that at the moment. But although Russia's not as big a market as China, it is one of those markets where the labels are, if only we could sort this out, there could be some good revenues to be made there. Spotify were talking about launching in Russia, and then they shut their office there, and now obviously that was possibly all tied in with the political conflict between East and West. But if Contactor could launch a streaming service, even if the royalties, as they often are in those other markets, are not quite what they are in the West, but if it was actually working and properly licensed and there was some money coming in, well, that would be a good thing. So
it's a start, isn't it? It's getting somewhere.
So is it goodwill, or is it goodwill in inverted commas, and it will all come to nothing? So we don't know, but it's an interesting development.
We're rapidly running out of time on the CMU podcast this week because we talked about the digital pie for ages.
And we've got to free up some time for this little nugget of gold that Andy's going to slip into the last bit.
Yeah, yeah. But we've just got time to talk about the things that we didn't have time to talk about. Let's start with, SFX Entertainment.
So
more going on there.
The EDM powerhouse that is SFX, which owns a multitude of EDM festivals worldwide, and of course Beatport. They rejigged their management this week, put out one of those classic statements of words that just don't mean anything in the order they put them out, about rejigging their executive structure. They moved the COO of SFX across the company into be CEO of Beatport. And there's quite a few things happening at Beatport that suggests that Beatport's going to become more of a media brand. It will continue to have a download store and a streaming service, but they're going to use that name a lot more. Maybe that SFX is the corporate trading name and Beatport could, I think, become sort of the consumer-facing brand that they use across their operations. And then there is also Robert Silliman, who set up SFX. So he set up many entertainment businesses over the years. This is his latest one. He floated it 2 years ago.
Now he wants it back.
Now he wants it back. And in order to get it back, i.e. in order to persuade his shareholders to sell him their shares to put it back into private ownership, he had to go through the ruse then, and I can't say that because there are independent people involved in this. So this wasn't just a PR charade, I don't think. But they said anyone else could come forward and make a bid, okay, just in case there was someone out there who would offer to pay more than Silliman is offering to pay to buy back the shares in his own company. So lots of developments behind the scenes at SFX this week.
The smoking gun has been found in the Happy Birthday case, which is a sentence it really pleases me to say.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it. I think the Happy Birthday case is something for us to talk about at great length
when it's
another week.
Yeah.
But the Happy Birthday, is there copyright in Happy Birthday? In Europe, yes, there's another year of copyright in Happy Birthday to You, which is why Andy is not going to sing it now.
I'm not.
Because we don't have
the
licenses.
Oh, no, I couldn't even sing the one they sing in TGI Fridays. They have a different song on TGI Fridays.
I don't, yes.
I've never been there to hear it, but someone told me that.
But
two people have told me that. It must be true.
The question is Happy Birthday still in copyright in the US? It's up for debate. And the people who think that there isn't copyright in Happy Birthday in the US came with a bit of evidence this week that they think proves it. So let's wait to see what the judge says.
Warner Music is no longer on Snapchat, which is really sad.
You're very sad about that.
No.
So Snapchat earlier this year launched a little content tab where you get sort of Snapchat-style content from a bunch of people. Vice are on there, for example. And the big music one, actually, I think MTV were in there too, but Warner Music were in there, which was interesting because none of the other record companies were. I don't quite know what they were doing because I'm not a Snapchat user. And by the time I got round to actually looking what was happening with the content bit of Snapchat, the Warner blob had gone because they added a few extra partners this week and they got rid of Warner. Although there was rumour that there is still partnerships going on behind the scenes between Snapchat and Warner. It's just that they decided having a blob alongside all those other media brands wasn't for them. So who knows?
Apple Music, this goes back to something we were talking about last week. Again, look at all the callbacks this week. Apple Music has 10 million users.
Say sources. Label sources speaking to Hits Daily Double in the US. So last week we were talking about the fact that Apple boss Tim Cook had been very vague. Millions and millions, he said, of people were now using Apple Music. Some label insiders. The labels normally have pretty good access, or not generally, but some people at the labels will have pretty good access to knowing how many people are signing up to the streaming services, because often the labels, one of the minimum guarantees that labels have from digital streaming platforms, I screwed that up then. I was going to say digital service platforms. Otherwise you'll start dissing me for saying digital stream.
Oh, yeah, I would.
Because you don't like digital download, do you?
I don't like digital. Yeah, digital streams is really a step too far.
But labels, some people at the big labels will know how many subscribers streaming services have because they'll get minimum guarantees based on the number of subscribers. And apparently the people talking to Hits Daily Double said, oh, it's quite impressive how many people have signed up, over 10 million. Although that sort of means 10 million people have upgraded their phone to the latest operating system, opened the music app, seen a button, pressed it, and then carried on with their lives. So,
yeah. I mean, Digital Music News published an article saying that there may be 10 million subscribers, but only a million of them are paying for it, which I'm not sure how that's possible,
yeah,
given
it's
that you
pay
can't
for
pay
moment,
for it currently.
Because everyone is still on the free trial, and you can't give them £10 even if you wanted to.
Avicii and Deadmau5 have talked about Noel Gallagher, things he was saying, which
so Noel Gallagher,
is foolish.
Noel Gallagher dissed EDM in The Enemy.
Who would have guessed that would happen?
And Avicii and Deadmau5 felt that this was something that they had to respond to.
Yeah, although Avicii did call him a silly sausage, so that was fun. And then Deadmau5 decided he agreed with him, although he made some quite large assumptions about what it was
that
he believed Noel Gallagher was saying.
Bearing in mind that Noel Gallagher basically said, I've not listened to any of this music, but I think it's rubbish, was basically what he was saying.
Yeah.
And Deadmau5 then assumed quite a lot of knowledge on Gallagher's part of the EDM scene.
Yeah, which I don't think he had.
And talking of beefs,
Drake and Meek Mill. So, this has been quite a thing, hasn't it?
Big fan of Meek Mill, are you?
Huge.
Huge, huge fan of Meek Mill.
Never got into Drake. I've really tried. I don't get it.
So Meek Mill had an album out earlier this year. I think I'm right in saying that. Crucially, he did collaborate with Drake. So there was a track out there.
Drake put a verse on one of his tracks,
which was a Meek Mill track with featuring Drake. And then subsequently, Meek Mill, I think he was initially dissing Drake for not bigging up that track on social media and stuff.
Drake did not tweet about the album. And then Meek Mill said, oh, and the reason he's not tweeting about it is because he uses ghostwriters and we found out and now he's angry that we know that he uses ghostwriters.
And so various people came forward from Drake's camp saying he does not use ghostwriters. Then Drake used his Beats One show to put out a diss track. I don't think he actually named Meek Mill, but basically he was sort of responding. Meek Mill, my favourite line in this so far was, Drake put this diss rap out on Beats One. And then Meek Mill said, well, I'll give him one thing. He clearly wrote that rap because it was rubbish. Then Meek Mill apologised, but then I think with hindsight he hadn't apologised. It's quite a confusing beef.
It certainly is.
The people behind this beef need to sort out the plot and better communicate it to us.
Yeah, this is because it's not going to be a very good film at the moment. But so, we'll see when the film of this week in rap comes out, how it plays out.
So, yes. And finally, Andy, what are we talking about? And I'm looking forward to the nugget of gold that's going to come out in this final section of this week's podcast.
Zayn Malik. He used to be in One Direction, as I'm sure you know. He may even be the one in One Direction whose name you knew. I can actually name all members of One Direction. But he left.
Both their names.
What do you mean both their
names? I mean as in a Christian name and surname for the other four.
I'm not going to list them off now. We haven't got time for that. I might name them gradually over the course of this.
As we go through the story.
Maybe that could be the gold.
What's Niall's surname?
Horan.
Oh, yeah, of course.
See?
Yeah, well done.
Anyway, Zayn Malik, he left One Direction saying that he wanted to go and be a normal 22-year-old and just live a private, normal life.
Didn't want to be a pop star anymore.
Yep. And then he spent quite a long time being in the public eye and not being a normal 22-year-old. And now he signed a management deal and a record deal. So good work.
So, yes, the interesting thing is he was the first one to leave One Direction, and immediately everyone was like, solo career, solo career, solo career, clever move, because obviously One Direction peaked. It's about 16 months ago now.
And they're splitting at the end of this year. I'm going to keep saying that.
They're splitting
at the end. Because if it happens.
Yeah, splitting later this year.
When it happens, when One Direction split at the end of this year, which is happening,
then
everyone will go, yeah, that Andy guy, he knew.
That guy who knows their names, all their names, he knew.
Louis Tomlinson.
So, yes, so when Zayn left, everyone was like, oh, solo career. And then Zayn was sort of like, no, I'm not having solo career. I just want to get out of the limelight, take a bit of time for myself. Then, of course, almost immediately, Naughty Boy, the producer, kept tweeting, oh, I'm in the studio with Zayn working on stuff.
Yeah.
And then it wasn't clear whether or not he was meant to be doing that or not. And
then there was a whole thing with Zayn and Naughty Boy falling out, apparently.
And they got, but I don't know. But clearly, Zayn is going to have a solo career. Got management. Term First Artists are going to be managing him.
And he's signed to RCA.
So interesting. So not gone with One Direction's management, Modest. Not gone with One Direction's label, which obviously is Psycho here
Although
in the UK.
Staying within Sony.
But staying within Sony. And Simon Cowell seemed to imply that he had been involved in negotiating this solo deal.
Yeah, it was interesting. Zayn tweeted the announcement that he'd signed this deal. And he said, I guess I never explained why I left One Direction. It was for this moment to be given the opportunity to show you who I really am. And then he tweeted a picture of him signing a contract in front of RCA's logo. So that's apparently in black and white. That's who he really is.
And there was a sort of, I can't remember whether it was an implication or whether it was an inference. I think there was a hashtag that made it an implication.
Real music.
Yes. That what he was saying was, yeah, all that One Direction thing, it was a sham, it was all manufactured pop, and now you're going to hear the real me.
Yeah, but as you say, Simon Cowell does seem to have been involved in this deal, so it's not like he's going, yeah, now I'm split off from that Simon Cowell fella, I can get on with making real music.
You see, he's not the first ex-Psycho artist to do a new deal and then sort of say... Oh,
well,
no.
Yeah, Leona Lewis did that earlier. That was her entire marketing campaign, was videos of her going, yeah, Psycho was rubbish. Although I don't think she ever actually named Psycho, but but because she's quite nice, it would all be like, yeah, I'm really glad I've got this new deal and I can finally record an album that really shows who I really am. But everyone I worked with in the past was so great and I had such a great time, but it was awful, but I loved it, but it was all terrible.
But I think the thing is that when ex-Psycho artists, you know, who came through the X Factor machine come out and say, oh, now I've got a new deal and I can actually make proper music that's me, I don't think Simon Cowell cares, because he's not under any illusions that he's making really credible, artistically groundbreaking music. He knows he's just a pop machine, and so I don't think he's offended at all when people say that.
No, and he tweeted.
But what about the other One Directioners like?
I was about to read...
You can't have Harry Styles as the one. There's a fifth one.
I was about to read Simon Cowell's quote, and cut straight across me.
Simon Cowell's quote.
He said,
if you were to do this in the voice of Simon Cowell, that could be the nugget of gold. Nugget of gold? Nugget of gold.
I don't think I can do Simon Cowell. Has Simon Cowell got an accent?
I don't know.
It's quite difficult, isn't it? Yeah. You already said Harry Styles, but I'm going to put him in. Anyway.
Well, you're saying that's all
anyway,
five.
Simon Cowell, he said, we have been working on this for a while, and I am pleased to say congratulations to Zayn Malik on signing with RCA. I believe that they are the perfect label for Zayn's solo career, and I am sure whatever they release together will be special. He didn't put hashtag real music.
So, Simon seems to approve. So, tell us, Andy, because you've been monitoring this situation closely, as we record this, how have the other One Direction members been celebrating this great bit of news for their former bandmate and, I assume, still best buddy Zayn?
Well, yeah, you'd think that, you know, Simon Cowell's fine with it. You'd think they'd all be tweeting, hey, well done, Zayn, that's really great, but no. Not at all.
So why don't you read out to our listeners what they have said so far about this deal? Yeah, that's what they've said about the deal so far.
Yeah.
They have no opinion on it.
None at all. I mean, I suppose they're all secretly hoping that they'll sign a deal as good as that.
Let's assume One Direction are going to wind down this year.
Which they are.
And then what, 2 to 3 years before they can come back and do the reunion circuit. So
I don't think Harry will want to go back. I think Harry will do well.
Well, that was going to be my question, is of the five, who do you think is, and I mean, it's who has got the really big solo career? And so it's the thing that people have always said, who's the Robbie Williams, who's the Gary Barlow? But Harry Styles is the cliched answer to that. I mean, ever since the group first came out, people have said Harry Styles is the one with the solo career. But I've since met some people in the industry who say, actually, I don't think that is true. I think, which is the Irish one?
Niall.
Two people have said to me they think he has the
I was about to say I don't think he'll get anywhere.
Oh, interesting.
I think he'll end up on TV.
So explain to us why you think Harry Styles having a successful solo career is not just a cliche.
Well,
statement.
Harry Styles is the obvious one for the solo career. Although that's, I was trying to think what member of Take That is, but no one in Take That has had a particularly successful solo career, so that's not a good example. I think Harry Styles could do it. I think Zayn will do all right.
And did he did you just well say to that get, no one in Take That has had a successful solo career?
Apart from Robbie.
Apart from Robbie Williams.
I forget that he was in...
For 10 years was the most successful pop star in Europe.
Yeah, I actually for a second forgot that Robbie Williams was in Take That. That's how successful he's been. So yeah, I reckon Harry Styles could be the Robbie Williams of One Direction. I think Zayn will do all right. I think Niall... Yeah. I think Niall and Liam could be successful in other places, probably not music. And Louis, maybe. We'll see. Maybe they just all disappear.
And we'll never hear from any of them ever again. So, well, Zayn's got the head start, if nothing else.
Yes. So well done, Zayn.
First to market as a solo former One Directioner. So what was that? It was record deal and management deal. So, I mean, One Direction do a good line in biscuits and crisps and tissues and sweets. Yep. So presumably there'll be a whole string of more deals for Zayn to do as he gets his solo career up and running. Hey, why don't you do all that stuff you do at the end of the podcast? Because we all agreed at the start, actually, that's the best bit. So that could count as the nugget of golden entertainment that everyone's been staying tuned for all this time.
Okay. Well, I may have mentioned earlier that you should definitely subscribe, review, rate, and share this podcast everywhere you can. There's lots of ways to share it, you know. You might be listening to it on SoundCloud. There's a link. Just share it. Put it on your Facebook. Send it to your mum. Email it to the Queen. I'm not sure what her email address is, but you've probably got it somewhere. Follow
us. @hotmail.com, I'd imagine.
Yeah, probably. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Those are places that where we share stuff. Twitter mainly, but you know, Facebook, that's a thing people use. Tumblr. We don't really use Tumblr anymore, but you can follow us on there anyway. People do. I looked the other day.
Did you?
Yeah.
Are we still tumbling anything?
No. Oh, no, we do. I think top stories automatically post.
They automatically
tumble. So if you want to see automatic posts of links to our top stories every day, Tumblr's the place
Tumblr
for you.
Tumblr is the place
Maybe
to
I'll start
go.
Using that again.
Have you done all your plugs?
Yes.
The Edinburgh Festival starts next week.
Oh, God.
I'm only saying because 3 Weeks, which is our magazine that covers the Edinburgh Festival, also has a podcast. So if you go to 3weeks.co.uk, then you can click the podcast button there and more. No Zayn Malik will be mentioned. No One Direction, no tedious copyright law, all culture, comedy and stuff. So check out the other podcast too, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, if you want.
Well, I have now.
You don't have to. I was talking to them, not you.
Oh, right.
Just, you know, don't feel pressured. It's fine. This podcast, this one here that we're listening to, was presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook, and it was produced by Matt Peaty. And for more information about what we do at CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, the CMU podcast is an unlimited production in association with 7 Digital.